20s for some. In Northern Ireland, another hot day coming up here. Temperatures again could reach around 28 degrees or so locally. And in Scotland, possibly 29 degrees around the Edinburgh area. That is a possibility. But again, the far north of Scotland prone to thicker cloud and occasional spots of light rain or drizzle. But for most of us, high levels of UV and high to very high levels of pollen accompany that hot sunshine that we're expecting. That's the latest weather. Diana.
Thank you. Now we begin a new book of the week. Penny Downey reads A Long Walk Home by Judith Tebbutt, the true story of her terrifying ordeal at the hands of Somali pirates. Her story begins in the autumn of 2011, when Judith and her husband embark on a dream holiday to Africa, culminating in a week at an idyllic beach resort in Kenya.
Love is, among other things, to wish for the happiness of the person whom you love. And I hadn't seen my husband quite so blissfully happy for some time. It was the 3rd of September 2011 and we were on safari in the Masai Mara, Kenya. We had reached our destination, Sirian Nkurumbo camp. David had set to unpacking immediately while I sprawled across the bed. I'm just going to have a look around outside, okay? Fine, I replied. My turn to unpack. I found him later, sitting, cradling his camera by the banks of the fast-flowing Mara River. All was peaceful but for the sound of the rushing waters. There was a golden light in the sky. Some baboons on the far-off bank were grooming one another. Further downriver, where the waters were calmer, hippos bathed in the sun, yawning and groaning. David, drinking it all in, wore a great smile on his face. But then we were in Africa, and Africa had played a huge and crucial role in our lives, in our coming together as a couple in the first place. We had been blessed by the place. It was our luck. We had been keen travellers throughout our married life, and our choice of holiday destination was usually initiated by David. The previous year, he suggested to me, let's do a safari next year. I fancied the idea of seeing gorillas in Uganda. David, though, had a long-standing passion to explore the Masai Mara. We compromised, as we always did. We would do the passion thing for David. The gesture in my direction was that after a week on safari, we would enjoy a beach holiday. Home comforts and pure, unadulterated do-nothing R&R. My beach suggestion was Zanzibar, but the safari consultants advised us that Zanzibar would entail most of a day's travelling. Might we consider the Kenyan coast? There was a place called Kiwayu Safari Village, where intrepid travellers could truly get away from it all. Previous guests had included Mick Jagger and Tracy Emin. The northernmost island of the Lamu Archipelago off Kenya's northern coast, Kiwayu sat 30 or 40 kilometres south of the border with Somalia. Neither David nor I thought anything of this proximity at the time. After two nights in our luxury tent at Sirian Nkurumbo camp, we moved the short drive away to their fixed camp. The Masai Mara was stunning, with its mountains and rivers, rolling plains dotted with herds of giraffe, elephants making their ponderous way, their young ones in tow. But the chief lure for the sightseer at this time of year was to witness the seasonal migration across the Mara of great herds of wildebeest in search of fresh grazing pasture. One morning, we parked up close to a neglected section of river, and were watching a sedentary herd of a few hundred zebra when two or three detached themselves and scrambled down a hillside to the riverbed, seemingly curious. It's happening, whispered our guide. Slowly, the zebras got to their feet and made themselves into a winding line, a procession that threaded down to the riverbank and picked its way across. Herds of wildebeest, which had only been dark dots in the distance, followed suit, and in short order, hundreds of animals were splashing across the Mara. David and I sat rapt, feeling privilege to witness it from only yards away. It was a strange post-colonial world David and I had stepped into back in 1976, the year we first met. Both David, an accountant, and my then-husband, Peter, an electrician, had been hired by Zambia Consolidated Copper Mines, a newly nationalised enterprise which was bringing in overseas specialists to ease the transition to state ownership. Peter and I had married young, the done thing, each knowing little of who the other really was. Too late, we found out we really had nothing in common, and nothing could change that. Not even our radical relocation from grey and rain-misty Cumbria to the heat and colour and aroma of Africa. It was at a squash club one day in Chililabombwe when I saw a man striding towards me. Handsome, fit, and tanned. He asked me if I could help him find his opponent, who I happened to know was already on court warming up. As this man walked away, he looked back at me, and we smiled at one another. No sooner had I met David than he kept cropping up in company. I had strong feelings for him of a kind I hadn't recognised before. The most remarkable feeling of completeness, as if for him and me to be sitting side by side in life, was exactly what fate had intended. One night, we ran into one another at the local arts theatre and he walked me home. For the next 2 or 3 months, David and I spent time together in a very chaste and secretive sort of romance. He drove me to places he loved, the bush, a big lake and its environs, which were home to crocodiles, egrets, hippos and blue monkeys. We took walks, confided our hopes in one another, and somehow we came to a decision. We didn't know how, but we wanted to be together. In the end, I left my husband, having packed a single suitcase, and took the flight home to England. For 6 months, David and I corresponded between Zambia and Cumbria, making plans for the life we would share. On the final morning at Sirian, we rose at our usual 6 a.m. and headed for Nairobi, where we boarded a small, 10-seater plane bound for KYU. The 2-hour journey passed off without incident, and as the plane started its descent, we were both struck by the vivid turquoise of the sea and the verdant forest with KYU Resort skirting its edge. The lower we got, the more keenly I was looking out for a landing strip of some sort. The plane circled over an opening in the forest, then came down to land in a field. This is remote, I thought to myself. As we arrived at the resort, a man came out to greet us, cheerfully informal, in t-shirt and shorts. George Moorhead, the resort's owner-manager. But for all George's evident friendliness, I had begun to feel a curious sense of isolation. There was simply nobody else around. No sounds of children laughing and playing or splashing water or hotel staff going about their business. Instead, the silence was pronounced. "It's amazingly quiet here," I remarked to him. "Where's everybody else?" He smiled. "You're in luck. You're the only 2 people here." We walked down onto the beach, which curved away ahead of us in a horseshoe shape. It was warm, the sand was firm, and the water lapped gently at our feet. But the headland seemed to me rather far away, and the longer we walked, the less comfortable I felt. We reached a spot where a row of bandas stretched out before our eyes around the curve of the bay. "Which one is ours?" I asked George.
"Just a bit further down. We've put you in Banda Zero."
We struggled up a soft sand slope, and there George introduced a waiting employee who would be looking after us, and we entered through a doorway with nothing more than a blind rolled over it. Inside, blinds were also rolled above the unglazed windows.
The sleeping area offered a big bed with white linen sheets and a mosquito net, neatly and protectively folded all around the bed frame. David must have read my expression. What's the matter? I'm not sure, David. I just feel a bit uneasy, being in a place that has no doors or windows. Chill, he said cheerily, the first time I'd heard him try out that expression. This will be our Robinson Crusoe experience. We dressed and left the banda in the fading light, retracing our route back down the beach to the restaurant. Dinner was simple, grilled fish and potatoes. Afterwards, we decided to have a nightcap and wandered over to a bar area. George Moorhead reappeared and pulled up a stool beside us. We sipped gin and tonics and he told us keenly about KYU. We had a second round of drinks, then, unusually for us, a third. I was feeling daunted by the thought of a trek back to the banda, but leaving George at the bar, we headed out, armed with a wind-up torch to help us find our way. Outside, the moonlight danced on the sea. All was still and peaceful. Flicking our torch, we spotted crabs emerging from the sand and scurrying away. We smiled at each other, and I took David's hand. Up ahead, we saw a light that could only be our banda, and we clambered back up the sandy slope, pushed the door's roller blind aside, and went in. David and I parted the mosquito net and climbed into bed. We drifted off together, just as we always did, lightly holding each other's hand as we lay there. A shout startled me out of sleep. The light was on, and in an instant, it was as if I had been slapped awake. David was out of the bed. He was standing with his feet planted, arms outstretched above his shoulders as though he were locked in a tussle with someone taller than him. He was looking rigidly up and ahead, wide eyes, and clearly alarmed. I felt a prod, as if from a stubby finger, but harder, metallic. I looked left and made out two more figures standing within the net. In the turmoil of the moment, I thought they must be KYU security guards. Some emergency had arisen. They'd come to ensure we were safe. But why was David shouting? The two men seized me tightly by my upper arms and began to haul me towards the doorway. I heard myself shout, "What's happening? What's happening?" I felt sand and twigs under my bare feet as I was bustled sideways down the incline and onto the firmer sand of the beach, the two men dragging me along between them. I was screaming, trying to impede our progress by digging my heels into the sand. I had to get back to David. We splashed in and out of the shallow tide waters. Still, I pleaded with them. "What are you doing? Where are you taking me? Stop it. Take me back. I won't say anything." They stayed grimly silent. I was turned sharply into the sea. For a moment, I feared I was going to be drowned. Instead, in that horrible stillness, I saw a fisherman's skiff gliding closer. I was shoved upwards from behind, and I keeled forwards into the boat, tumbling and banging my temple. Two other figures came splashing through the water towards us from the shore. They must have left David behind so they could make their getaway. The engine came to life with a high-pitched whine. Then the skiff lurched off and away. It felt as though I were being catapulted, fired out of a gun. In the sky to my right, the moon was huge and luminous. I looked back and watched, helpless, as the shoreline raced away from me.
And tomorrow, Judith finds herself in the lawless state of Somalia, still clinging to hope that her husband will secure her release, as Penny Downey reads the next instalment from A Long Walk Home by Judith Tebbutt. The abridger was Miranda Davis, and the producer was Justine Willett. Now, to take us to the shipping forecast, here's Sailing By. And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 9th of July. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, high dogger 1035, expected rockall 1031 by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, southwesterly, veering northerly 5 or 6, occasional rain, fog patches, fair later, moderate, occasionally very poor, becoming good. South Utsira, northwesterly 5 or 6, occasionally 7 later, rain for a time, good, occasionally poor. Forties Cromartie, west or southwest, veering north later, 3 or 4, occasionally 5 in forties, fog patches, good, occasionally very poor.